With the Redfin app, you'll know the moment your next place hits the market. Whether you're looking to buy your dream home or rent a sweet apartment, give Redfin your gotta-have-it wish list of property features, and you'll receive real-time notifications tailored just for you. Ready to see it up close and personal? Scheduling a tour is just a tap away. Don't wait to find your perfect match. Download the Redfin app and start searching today.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week.
Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Life isn't what happens, it's what you do with what happens. It's your attitude, it's your reactions, it's your actions. It's how you get back up when you get knocked down.
Never quit. Never quit radio.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the TNQ podcast. I'm your host, Marcus Luttrell. Every week, it's my job to fire you up, to ignite the legend inside of you, and to push you to your greatness. Join me every week as I take you into my briefing room with some of the most hard-charging people on the planet. They're going to show you how to embrace the suck of life, teach you the values of working your ass off, and charge through whatever life throws at you. This is the Team Never Quit podcast. So buckle up, Buttercup.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the Team Never Quit podcast. As always, thank you guys for listening and watching, and please hit that like and subscribe button if you like to see the show. So today, before we get to our special guests, let's kick it off with our weekly Patreon question. And this week we have got, if you had to choose, would you live in a super hot region or a super cold region?
For sure hot for me. I was born in Louisiana, raised in Texas, have never been in the cold for more than 4 days at a time, and I cannot handle the cold. So mine is absolutely hot.
I'm with you. It's got to be hot. He's from Maine. I last maximum 4 days there in the winter. I need warmth. Mm-hmm. I cold makes me angry. The colder I am, the more angry I get.
It makes me shut down. Like, I physically can't go outside or do anything. And so I just stay huddled up in the bed and like look at things I can do online because I can not function when it's cold.
I don't like the heater coming on. It messes with everything.
If I'm cold, I need a heater. Like, I can't be outside. I can't feel, like, it gets in my bones, and I feel the cold in my bones, and it makes me feel like I'm going to die, and I hate it.
Same.
I've been in Texas, almost 20 years now, Rio Grande Valley. I don't need that. I don't need that hot. Something with seasons would be nice, though. I like winter. I grew up in Maine. I like the winter.
Do we get to pick the seasons?
No, you get
just crazy hot or crazy cold.
Are you living in Finland or are you living in Africa?
I mean, I think I've lived in both. I mean, like northern New England, deep south Texas. And I think if I had to choose one or the other, you can always put another log on the fire. You know, you can't take all your clothes off. So
yes, you can.
I guess you can. Yeah. You can only get so cool in hot weather, right?
Yeah.
I'm probably with you on that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that air conditioning is a great blessing from the Almighty that we have that, and then hot water. It's funny because I love hot water, but when the hot air, especially with the humidity in it, I don't really prefer that.
What about you, Hunter?
I'm definitely going hot. I could just be in the hot climate all day, every day. unlike you, I can definitely just take off layers all the time and not really have a care in the world. So yeah. I'm going that route.
I can function outside when it's hot. I can work in the garden. I can do, you know, I can do things outside when it's hot. But when it's cold, I can't go out there and do anything.
If we're going to break this thing down technically, then at night, I like it cold.
Same.
And in the daytime, I like it hot. Okay, can we do that? Because I can't. I don't like sleeping in the when it's freaking hot. Well,
then you pick the right place to live here because it's 30 degree temperature swing season right now. Yeah,
I mean, 50
in the morning, 80 at night.
Question down. Yeah. Let's do it like
this
that.
This morning, our children were wearing hoodies, and this afternoon they're going to be wearing t-shirts and
Texas,
shorts.
Right, it's awesome.
Yeah.
That's a good question.
I love that. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank y'all for doing this, Christopher Lace.
Yeah.
Christopher Healy, man, we're welcome to the team.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome. I already earned it, so well done.
Appreciate
you.
Thank
you. We're going to back it up a little bit more and introduce everybody to you. So where do you come from?
Originally, born in Illinois, moved around a bit, but settled in Maine when I was six and moved from my dad's career. So we ended up there and spent most of my life there, got through college there. And then after college, I was intending to be an archaeologist. I went to college at the University of Maine. I got into grad school, was going to go for archaeology. Took a year off to work with one of my professors, and that was 2001. And I was working on an archaeological dig in September 2001 when, obviously, we got attacked. And that sort of changed my mindset about what I wanted to do with my life. There's a longer story to it, but the short story is I called the FBI recruiter in Boston. I said, you know, how do I do what you guys are doing? I want to be a part of, you know, fighting back. And he said, listen, we're not hiring right now unless you speak Urdu, you know, Pashtun, Arabic, Persian, or unless you got, like, you know, tactical experience, which I obviously didn't as a recent college grad. And so they said, well, keep an eye on USA Jobs. I'd never heard of that before. Keep an eye on USA Jobs. There's going to be a lot coming up because, you know, this is going to be a long fight, basically. And I kept my eye on USA Jobs. As soon as something started opening up, I started applying. ICE, CBP, Border Patrol, you name it, any police job I could find. And got plucked up by ICE, and they sent me 2,600 miles from the northern border down to Harlingen, Texas, which y'all know, you've been to, I'm sure.
It's down there.
Yeah, you've been there. So you've been through Raymond.
I've been there, bro. Yeah, plenty of times. Love it down there, but it's way down there.
It was about a 3-day drive from Maine to get down there, and that just, you know, I got down there. I was down there about 3 months. I was looking for the exit. It's like, this ain't it. You know, it was culturally, it was entirely different. Geographically, it was entirely different. Weather, hot versus cold. And then I met Lacey while I was there. And I was like, this place is all right. I can stick around for a minute. But I worked for ICE down there for about 3 years. And I got picked up by the Internal Affairs Group from Homeland Security, which is called the OIG, Office of Inspector General. And I started working Internal Affairs cases, which is right around the time that the Gulf Cartel was going through a civil war. They arrested OCL Karnisgian. He gets extradited to the U.S. He starts diming out every dirty Border Patrol agent, every dirty CBP officer that he had paid money to over years. And that right then is when I got picked up with Internal Affairs. So I kind of got thrown right into the fire of going after all these dirty and corrupt Border Patrol agents and CBP officers. Worked on a bunch of big cases involving public officials, the Hidalgo County Sheriff and his son and all that stuff. We arrested a bunch of guys and spent, what, about a decade, I guess, down there in the Rio Grande Valley. After Hurricane Harvey, got a chance to move out of the valley. My agency also did all the FEMA fraud stuff, and so we got really busy up here, obviously.
Was that bad?
Yeah, still going on. There's still Harvey cases being made.
You know what we hear, but what really happened, that's bad, right?
What is a FEMA fraud case? What happens with that?
So, you know, like how the government likes to throw money at problems, basically. So anytime a storm happens, anytime there's wildfires, anything like that, DHS comes in and, you know, Congress through the, I think it's like the William Stafford Act, they come in, they give a whole bunch of disaster benefit funds to that area. And everybody's lining up and the government just gives out money to everybody sticking their hand out. And a lot of those people sticking their hand out, they don't deserve it. You know, they don't actually have something that got damaged or destroyed. And so my agency came back in after the fact and we had to kind of clean up those messes. We had to find out where, you know, municipality had, say, a bunch of busted up fire trucks they're going to get rid of, but they chalk that up to Hurricane Harvey, right? And so they're asking for $2 million from the federal government to replace their already damaged equipment or whatever. And then there's people. I mean, there's a ton of people that take advantage of those situations. Whenever there's a storm, whenever there's wildfires, whenever there's really any natural disaster, there's a ton of people who are going to come in, stick their hands out and say, I'll take some of that too. And so 2-3 years after the fact, Congress starts asking questions like, you know, what happened to that money that gets spent right? And that's when, you know, we come in and we start cleaning that up. So I did that for a while in both in San Antonio and in Houston. But in the midst of all of that, I kind of got involved in elder fraud cases. I was the duty agent in the Rio Grande Valley. So every third week, I was on call 24/7 for a full week. And I would get called up all night long saying, hey, you know, there's been a shooting, there's been a whatever. And I would just go out and investigate anything. And my boss comes in one day when I was duty agent, he drops a file on my desk. He said, there's a bunch of people up in the Houston area that have been getting these phone calls saying it's DHS calling them. And they're asking, you know, they're asking them to send money or they're going to be deported. And the people they're calling are mostly H-1B visa holders, folks from India who are like here on a visa for you know, 1-3 year period of time, making as much money as they can doing tech work. And then they go home. Well, those people were getting phone calls saying like, hey, you're going to be deported if you don't pay us a fine. You didn't fill out your paperwork right. And they were paying these fines. They would go down to like CVS or Walgreens, buying those like gift cards, those Green Dot cards, and loading them up with cash and sending them off to these people who are calling. And I was like, yeah, I'll take a look at that. And I started kind of scratching the tires or scratching the surface of it. And what it turned into over the course of just kind of looking at it was this massive conspiracy run out of India-based call centers where they weren't just calling and impersonating DHS. They were calling everyone in this country, impersonating the IRS, Social Security, mm-hmm. HUD, you name it. And for the next 6-7 years, my team and I tracked down and broke down that network. And we ended up ultimately arresting we indicted 61 individuals and businesses. So we indicted 4 call centers in addition to the like 56 people we indicted. And we ended up arresting 25 individuals in the U.S. And so that kind of became just randomly by being the duty agent and having this file land on my desk, that kind of became my passion, was going after the people who were telefraud, targeting our elderly folks in the U.S. and targeting our vulnerable people.
I remember calling you when we were working out together. I don't remember who it was. I can't think for the life of me. Someone called me and said, help, my mother or somebody had sent like a FedEx.
35 grand.
Yeah, yeah, with money, but I can't think of who it was.
It was a mom of, maybe it was a SEAL, like mom or mother-in-law, something like that. It was someone from y'all's network.
Yeah, it was definitely a friend of ours that reached out to us. And I was like, I think I have the person for you. And I called Lacey and you caught it.
We stopped it. It was like 35 grand cash. So that was, that towards the last few years of my career, that's all I was doing was interdiction of things like that. My team and I became very, very good at identifying who the runners were, who the network was in the U.S., tracking these people down. But when that call came in, it was very fortunate timing because I think the victim had just sent it. So it was still like, it was traveling outbound. It hadn't gone through the FedEx facility yet. And I was able to call the facility and have it stopped and held and get the cash turned around. Normally what happens is, you know, you're 70 something years old, you get a phone call and it's someone saying like, hey, your Social Security number's been compromised. I'm Special Agent so-and-so and you need to take all your cash out of the bank because we're going to cancel your Social Security number and send you another one. So you're an elderly person. You're already terrified, right?
Right.
So these people, they go down. They're lonely, especially during the pandemic. These folks are like isolated. Their kids aren't around, whatever. So they go down to the bank. They pull out all this cash. And they're literally taking cash and putting it in a box and sending it off to Special Agent whoever. And that's, I think, what that victim had done. And by the time they realize, it's too late. By the time they realize that cash has been picked up, typically they're shipping it to like a CVS or a Walgreens where it's being held and the guy comes in with a fake ID, he picks it up, and then he goes and dumps that cash into a bunch of different bank accounts and just kind of launders the proceeds. And he does that 10, 15, 20 times a day. And then he moves on to the next city and the next city and the next city. And meanwhile, there's guys all around the country doing that same thing. And this call center is just moving on to the next person. They're just dialing for dollars.
How are they finding these people?
It started out... So like the H-1B stuff that I started when it was like people impersonating DHS, what was happening is individuals were putting their information up on job boards. Like think of like, what's it like LinkedIn or whatever,
mm-hmm. but
like
Indeed.
Or Indeed. Right.
Yeah.
But there's like a Indian version of that called Dice. And they were posting on Dice, hey, I have an active H-1B and I'm currently working in Houston for, you know, name an oil and gas company. And people in India in these call centers would set up fake job profiles. So they would create a fake company and then they would start looking at all these resumes of H-1B holders who were advertising their information and they would start calling them. And they would start saying, hey, you didn't fill out your paperwork right when you got that H-1B. You owe us $10,000. You owe us $15,000. And these people, they're terrified, right? Because all the money they're making, it's going back to India. It's supporting sometimes dozens of people in their hometown. They might be the only one who's gotten out of there. And they're making real money in the U.S. They're sending it back. And it's going to fund an entire community.
Is that legal, by the way?
What, send money back?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yes, you have to declare. I mean, there's different forms. Yeah. You have to declare everything. But yeah, broadly, yes. But these folks would get picked on that way. But they realized that that was a really small pond they were fishing in and that everybody in America pays taxes. And so, you know, you start like dialing for dollars. You start buying lead lists, all that stuff you can sell. Like anytime you go, remember you used to go in the movie theater? Like we're all that age where you go to the movie theater and you'd see like you fill out the form to win the free motorcycle, you know, yeah. there in the lobby or whatever. All that is that's, you know, the old school way of like, let me get your email address or whatever. You know, you create a marketing list. Well, they would buy lead lists like that, and they would just start dialing for dollars. And they just started, like, calling the phone book and auto-dialing. And they would do, like, you'll see the phone numbers come in if you're in the Houston area. It's going to come in from a 713 or a 281 or a 936 or whatever. That's what they were doing. They were buying voice over IP numbers for certain area codes and then just bombing that area. And just calling and saying, hey, you owe us money. Hey, you owe us money. And it's a percentage game. There's a certain amount of people who are going to fall for that, and they're going to do it. And typically, those people trend older. Like, my average victim age was 73. So most of the folks I was dealing with, it just, every time I would talk to a victim, it was like, gosh, I'm talking to somebody who's literally lost everything. So it's sometimes millions of dollars over the course of months. They would continue paying these people.
Oh, my gosh.
So, yeah.
So when you prosecute, like, when you actually busted this case, were you able to get any of the money back for these people?
So it was about $300 million. We estimate about $300 million case. The one that I worked, it was the largest telefraud case in U.S. history. And we identified about $300 million in loss. And that was from 15,000 plus victims that my team interviewed, spoke to, took statements from over the course of about 6-7 years. We were able to physically recover about $1.2 million of that.
Mm.
So that money it's gone. And what I always tell my victims is you're going to get a lot more justice than restitution. But if you stick with me, if you let me do the work, you're going to get justice. But, you know, your money's probably gone. I would set that expectation from the beginning. We did seize one of the kind of the kingpin type characters. He's doing 20 years now. He's got probably like 15 left, but he had bulk silver, bulk gold in his house when we ran the search warrant. We were able to seize some physical assets, but by and large, the money that they're getting, they're taking a percentage, they're taking a cut, and then the rest is being distributed. And it's basically a money laundering conspiracy. And the way I look at it is, you may be familiar. Have you ever heard the term hawala?
Uh-uh.
No. It's basically, it's an ancient money movement system. And what it is in India and Iran and other places in the Middle East in particular, it's a trust-based money transfer system. So let's say you're in India and your daughter's going to school at the University of, let's say, LSU, and you want to get tuition to that kid at LSU for the semester. You've got $10,000. You go to what's called a hawala broker, this guy in India, and he's got a trusted partner somewhere in the States who he says to that guy, put $10,000 in this bank account. And then they make each other whole over time. Right, so this guy in the United States, now this guy owes him $10,000 or vice versa, right? And so they get made whole over time by a series of complex transactions. A lot of times the guy in the U.S. owns a Indian Pakistani grocery store, and the guy in India will supply him items for his grocery store over time to make that debt whole. But money never actually changes hands. That's what was happening here. They were replacing that with filling those orders with fraud dollars. So all these bank accounts were just getting $10,000 dropped in them, $9,000 dropped in them. We'd go and talk to the people who own the bank accounts and tell them you just got stolen money. And they had no idea. They just knew, oh, my dad was going to send my tuition check. I don't know where that came from. And that's what was happening. So $300 million just disappeared into the U.S. banking system, just like little, like smurfed into different accounts all over the place. So, yeah.
That's some swordfish type stuff right there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a deep cut.
Yeah. That's crazy. I have two fraud experiences like that. One, my friend Kristen, that one of my best friends, and she's my age. And he called her while we were driving to an event one time. We were going to meet you, I think. And this guy, it was an Indian guy, said he was with the IRS, said that she needed to go at that moment and wire a certain amount of money or the police were going to come get her.
Yeah.
And she was freaking out. And I said, put that on speaker. I'm with her. I'm driving. And I said, put it on speaker. What is he saying? And then I said, and my stepdad actually works for the IRS. And I said, they don't call you.
No.
They're not going to call you and demand money. And she was like, I have to do something. I owe whatever. She might have owed like $100. It wasn't a lot of money that she owed, but he was saying she owed thousands of dollars in like late fees or something. And I said, this is not right. This is a fraudulent thing. And so I started recording it on my phone. And I don't even remember, I think we tried reporting it, but it didn't go anywhere. And she ended up hanging up on him. But it was crazy because I actually heard this guy in action trying to pressure her. And he sounded so, minus the very strong Indian accent, he sounded very convincing.
Well, they're professionals.
Yeah.
Right? They're pros at, because they think of it, they call thousands of people a day, right? So if you're in sales, and I compare the psychology of this to a really effective salesman, it's the same. Like you're trying to find that rapport with someone. You're trying to get them under the ether to know, like, and trust you. And so they have a lot of reps in. Mm-hmm. I mean, they get hung up on all the time, but it only takes one to make their week.
Yeah.
And so you get one on the hook. But they're getting reps in, day out. They're pros at it. And they sound very good, and they overcome objections very well. They're great at the verbal judo. And they train for this and practice for it. And what's wild about it is the people who operate these call centers, they run them like a business. They're really criminal cartels. But we had people sometimes, not often, but we had guys in the call centers that would call and give us information. They would say, hey, I signed up for this job thinking it was this, and I found out we're doing this, and I want to give you information so that you can help, like, take this down. And so we would get information from guys in the call centers.
Insiders, yeah.
And they would send us pictures, and it looked like any office building in, you know, Metro Houston. It's like people in, like, business casual, like they had like ID tags to scan in, scan out. They had like LLCs and foundational paperwork. They call it BPOs over there, but they had the same sort of formation paperwork. And when I started getting into, I ran over 200 search warrants on email accounts. I seized over 4 million emails in the course of this investigation. And went through like all of them. She can account for it.
But Lisa, I was very done with this by the time it was over.
But we would go through it, and they would talk to each other like any business, right? It was like, you know, sending the emails were the record of the transactions, but it was like very professional. It was very businesslike. And, you know, it'd be like, take care of this. And they refer to their victims as customers in this traffic back and forth. So it's a very, like, you have to consider them. It's not like a stick-up guy, right, where you're getting, like, you know, mugged on the street corner. Like, mm-hmm. These people are businessmen, but their business is crime. And you kind of have to look at it in that perspective.
Well, and now they're doing AI, where they're mimicking your family member's voice. That happened to my grandmother.
Game changer.
Yeah. And my grandmother gets a call from who she thinks is her grandson, my little brother. And he says she needs to wire, like, I don't know what it was, $20,000 or something. And she goes, I don't know how to wire. I don't think I could do that. She had never wired any money before. And he said, you have to do this or you're going to go to jail. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, that's what it was. He was going to go to jail. So my little brother's voice is saying that he got in a car wreck.
Yeah.
And injured somebody, a pregnant woman, and he was going to go to jail if she didn't wire this money. And she's saying to him, like, I don't think I can do that. I don't know how to do that. And he said, whatever you do, don't call my parents. Mm. And she hangs up and calls my mom and her daughter, because she's like, he said I can't call you, but I don't know what to do. I don't know. I don't think my bank wires. She's from a really small town and banks with a really small bank, which I'm sure they do wire, but she didn't know what that was. And my mom says, that is not true. He is not calling you. He's in class right now. And my mom's got Life 360. She looks and he's sure enough in class.
Yeah.
And calls him and checks and he is in class and he's not making this phone call. My mom looks it up online and there is this AI voice scamming thing going on. And thank God my grandma didn't know how to wire the money or else she would have been victim to this. That's insane that they can copy our voices.
Q. That's goodrx.com/TNQ.
The two generations that, so our average age of our, most of our victims in the IRS scam, or what it evolved later into what's known as a Social Security Administration scam, which is, I think, what the victim that you were dealing with that you called me about, fell prey to, same people. They just change the agency they're impersonating and you know, fine tune it. They're always learning and getting better. And they've used AI very effectively. But that grandson in jail thing, you can tell there's certain hallmarks to these scams. Like grandson in jail is typically Jamaica. Mm. Like they're that lottery scams, typically Jamaica. Puppy scams or advanced fee frauds where they advertise, like, you know, dogs for sale or things like purebred dogs. 80% of the websites you find online where you're looking for, like, your next puppy are scam. They're going to be advanced fee frauds. They're going to get you into an advanced fee fraud. Those are typically from West Africa. And then the government impersonation stuff, the payday loan stuff, the Amazon impersonation stuff, all that's from India. But the two generations we that fell victim the most in the stuff that I was investigating were that broad span. It was the 70-plus, the boomers, and then it was typically the younger folks, like the folks who grew up with a phone in their hand or grew up on the internet, who think nothing of, yeah, why wouldn't the government accept Bitcoin for payment? Or why wouldn't it, you know, why wouldn't the IRS take gift cards? Because that seems normal to younger millennials and Gen Z types. And then the boomers are very trusting. They trust, I mean, the phone rings, they answer it, right? Yeah. Somebody calls them and they say, yeah, of course, yeah. You know, like they actually still have landlines a lot of the time, right? But like us, like the Gen Xers, nobody fell for this in Gen X because we're all so damn cynical. Just right? Like, I was just like, click. Is, right? Yeah, I think it is, truly. I mean, it's our superpower. Like,
I'm calling bullshit. Like, when my mom
come up with something better than that, man. Yeah. call me back. Let me get the guys. You know, something like that.
And I'll put my kids on the phone. I'll put like her on the phone. Like if they call, like they will occasionally, like these call centers will occasionally, if they know your address or they know information about you, they've swatted people. They've sent SWAT teams to people's houses. They've called in like kidnapping or bomb threats, things like that to mess with people. But generally, if you keep them on the phone, you're just wasting their time and money because they pay for that voice over IP. They have to pay for that time on the line. So I'll bleed them out. I'll pretend I'm an elderly individual. I'll keep it going as long as I can.
There's some brilliant people on the internet that you can watch do that.
We've worked with some of them. Yeah.
Hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of the scam baiters.
So whatever type of person that is that can do that,
oh, yeah,
is amazing to me.
Yeah. We've worked with some of those guys with the big YouTube accounts and you know, where they have information that they can share with us that we can be actionable on from a law enforcement perspective, they've shared with us. And then other times there are things that we can't do. We can't reach out and touch. And, you know, we'll give them some information about where a call center might be located and let them do their magic. So we've incorporated a lot of that. But AI has it's up the game. Exactly what you're saying. Yeah. People are impersonating voices. And, you know, I thought a lot about my grandfather. I thought a lot about her grandparents. You know, I thought about, like, who's falling victim to this? Even her mom would get those calls. And would, mm-hmm. I would get calls from family members. I get calls from all sorts of her clients. Mm-hmm. Parents would call me. Like, and to the extent that I could, I would always try to help, because when an when a person in their 70s is losing $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, I mean, that might be the difference between them being independent and losing that independence.
Absolutely.
That might be everything that they've got. That's their retirement. Right? And they work their entire lives together. We had some of the victim impact statements when we brought this case across the finish line. We prosecuted it here in Houston. And the judge was, I mean, we got the best judge and the best district court judge we could have gotten. I mean, he hammered these guys. He read every single victim impact statement. So we had, like I said, about 15,000 victims that we were aware of. And I think that probably is representative of maybe 1% to 2% of the victims that are out there, because the vast majority of people, you get victimized by a crime like this, you don't want anyone to know, right? Like most people, like they realize they've been scammed and they either talk themselves into, I wasn't scammed, or they're not going to share it with their kids, with their grandkids.
They're embarrassed.
They're embarrassed, right? The psychology of being scammed is no different than the psychology of being mugged on the street, right? You feel the same afterwards. You feel like unsafe. You feel like you don't make good decisions. You become hypervigilant. So that same sort of psychological impact exists, whether you had a gun stuck in your face and your wallet stolen, or you were robbed over the internet. And so I was kept that in mind. And like, I listened to thousands of stories of these people calling. I mean, like she can tell you like all day and night, like these people had my cell phone. They'd call me like, what's going on with the case? Where are we now? Can you talk to my son? I finally told him about this, all that stuff. And just like, it just rips like your just guts out to hear these people. So any small victory where we could intercept a package of cash like that, actually get turned around to someone was just, we did more. We only recovered about $1.2 million in that big case, but I probably in the course of the last couple of years of my career, when they started shipping cash more, I was able to recover a lot more because we were able to interdict and actually return it to people. And so that felt really good because we were actually able to make an impact.
You remember that movie when we were kids, Boiler Room?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Ben Affleck.
It's like that, right?
Ben Affleck. Yeah. It's like that.
That kind of setup?
Yeah, yeah.
So some of those levels don't know what the next levels do, and it's all ruled by alpha males, right?
Right. But think about this. Like you have in India, like you've got like a 5-story office building, and on floor one, they're doing IRS. On floor two, they're doing Social Security.
They're separated,
right?
So you can't, one person, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're all, but they're, it's like you're talking a 50 seat dialer, 200 seat dialer, and they're just going nonstop, just dialing for dollars.
Have you seen the movie Beekeeper?
Not yet.
The newer one that came out?
Not yet. No. Jason Statham, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I just watched that one this past week. Honestly, didn't know that it revolved anything around scammers, but it's literally to a T exactly what you just said. Kind of just a professionalized market of scamming people. And yeah. I mean, it lays out the whole nine yards of it. I definitely recommend watching that movie.
Does Jason do it right?
Oh, yeah. He does a great job.
He always does, right?
Uh-huh. I say,
and now that you know that it's out there and that he sets a standard for that, one of our guys will do that.
Yeah, no, he could play me in the movie if they ever make Operation Outsource the movie. But we didn't get to go and bust heads or anything like that. By and large, like it was, Lacey referred to it as nerd crime. She was like, my husband fights nerd crime, and I take that as a badge of honor because like I looked at it as, these guys are really, really smart. This is an incredibly smart scheme that they've set up. It's an incredibly smart conspiracy to be able to figure out and think this through. And a lot of these people had been visa holders themselves. They'd come to the U.S. They understood our system. They understood how things worked. A lot of them had worked in legitimate call centers, so they understood how they should talk to customers. They had a lot, and their English is excellent, aside from being heavily accented. And so for me, the game was, okay, you're really smart. You're stealing millions of dollars. Credit to you. Like, I want to be smarter than that.
There was no, the fact that that landed on his desk was like fate in itself. Because I think if anybody else in his office would have gotten that, they would have been bored of it inside of a couple of days. Because it really, I remember the day, I remember cooking dinner. And I remember the day that he came in and he was like, I got this and I'm, you know, kind of working on this. And I remember the beginning of like the spider web. He had like a spider web of like, it was like, okay, I'm looking at here. And he started connecting the dots and it was on a wall. And I remember him starting to do that. And he gets very into things, like very...
That's some true detective type stuff right
he's,
there.
I love that kind of stuff.
So that was a common meme.
It was like,
not all that unlike that.
That's a compliment, by the way.
Yeah, I appreciate it because it was like that. Like, do you know the Always Sunny in Philadelphia meme where like, you know, Charlie Day is like standing there and he's got all the, right. You know, the strings? That was like my office. It was like that. Or like, you know, the True Detective where Matthew McConaughey's sitting in the storage unit. It was like that. I mean, it was.
The cool part, there was a moment, you had been doing this for like 2 years and you were by yourself.
I am so like that. Like, if I would have been in y'all's household, I would have been researching it. And I love the detail in trying to catch somebody like that.
The timing of it was consequential too. Because this landed on my desk in the summer of 2013. And that May, I had done my first Ironman. And so, and I wore this hat, I think. That's why it's like, this was like important to me. Because I did for the Lone Survivor Foundation. I raised money for an Ironman one time. But I had done my first Ironman, so you're quite welcome. I was glad to do it. And I had this like crazy idea in my head of like, well, if I could do that, I could take on this case. So it was like that attitude of once you do something insanely hard, everything else seems like, you know, something you can accomplish. So you've got that well of experience to draw from. And the two things were completely different. This was a physical challenge, incredible physical challenge. And then this was a, you know, really like a mental thing. But the idea that if I could do this, if I could complete this insanely hard thing, then why can't I take this on? And what Lacey says, right, like people, the problem with these telefraud scams is that most people, when they do report them, and very few people do, when they do report them, they go to their local PD. And their local PD is going to say, listen, this is probably international based. There's not much we can do about it. Our resources are limited. Money's probably gone. I'm sorry. You can fill out a police report, but it's probably not going anywhere. And then what they'll do is they'll take that report, maybe, and they'll upload it to a couple of different databases that exist nationwide. So there's one that the FTC runs, and there's one that the FBI runs. And maybe those things get uploaded, but then they just sit there in a database. Nobody's looking at that on a daily basis. My team and I started looking at those. We started saying, okay, if I had a victim here in Houston, what are some like hallmarks in here that I can cross-reference in the database? So they'd go down Sugarland PD or Stafford PD, and they would make their complaint. And I developed relationships with the detectives in those units and said, okay, where are most of my H-1B visa holders living? They're living in Telfair Estates down in like Fort Bend County, or they're living in New Colony down in Fort Bend County. And so I would go in, I would say, okay, are you getting reports? If you get any reports, bring them to me. And then I would cross-reference. I'd say, okay, they're using this name. Everybody's saying, you know, the person who's calling is identifying himself as Kevin Marsh, or the person who's calling is identifying himself as, you know, a agent with this agency in this office. And I would cross-reference those little data points, and I would find more victims from that same time frame. And what we found was they were using a voice over IP number for a very specific amount of time. It might last for a month. It might last for 6 months. But once we got onto one of the numbers that we were using, we could start pulling all sorts of data and start identifying victims. And then you would start bringing those victims together, and you're starting to see the elephant. And that's kind of how I likened it. It was like, there's like a story about three blind men trying to describe an elephant, right? And like each one of them is feeling their part of the elephant and is describing it. And, you know, one's got the trunk, one's got the tail, one's got an ear. And they're all describing a different animal. And it's not until you step back, you give it that 30,000-yard view, that you realize what an elephant really is. You start putting all those pieces together. And that's kind of what happened. I started kicking the tires on this thing, and it lasted for me alone from July until December.
He was obsessed with this for almost 2 years. And I remember the day when you were like, there is another guy. There's another guy that's doing, he's looking at the same thing. He's in California. He's looking for this thing. I found another guy. And they started piecing together their team that came together, that all realized in different parts of the United States, they had all been looking at the same thing. And it's uncanny because they're basically all just variations of each other. So if you get them in the same room, they'll drive you insane because they're just, they each have a personality trait that allowed them to take on this thing that nobody else would have really wanted, but they all took it on, and they all have such like unique traits that when they finally got in the same room. And I think like all of the wives, like we all know each other now because they did this for so many years. Like how many kids were born in the like time, kids are born and adopted in the time you guys were doing this?
So we referred to ourselves, we kind of created, we would, it was basically deconfliction, right? It's like if I would send a subpoena to a bank and say, I want to know the money that was deposited in this bank account. I want to know when it got there. I want CCTV, the video footage of the guy depositing. I want everything you can tell me about this, right? And finally, after doing that several hundred times, somebody else had subpoenaed that same bank account. And that's how we kind of connected and deconflicted. So they were like, hey, you got to call this guy in San Francisco because he just literally sent a subpoena for that same account. You guys are probably fishing in the same pond. And so that's how I met the guys. There was a guy in Oakland, two in San Francisco. There was a Secret Service agent up in Chicago. And we kind of put this little mini task force together. And we referred to ourselves because we had no funding. We had no backing. We had no, you know, the federal government, when they put task forces together, generally it's like DEA gets task forces because they seize money and assets and they pay the government, right? They don't cost the government money. We were going after a ghost. We were going after people in India that we couldn't reach out and touch, money that was gone. There was no, like, the government didn't have a lot of incentive to fund us on this wild goose chase unless we could make a big splash and make an impact. And that was going to take time. So having numbers, having guys that I could add to that made a big difference. We referred to ourselves colloquially as the six guys who give a shit. And that's what we call it. That was our task force. We were the six guys who give a shit. And that's all we were. Because we were the six guys in the country who were like, this stops with us. Like these scam calls, like I don't know if we can stop this. I don't know if we can reach out and touch these guys. I don't know how many people we can put in jail, but we're going to give it an effort and we're going to try. And we all had that same attitude. I think it helped because we were all about the same point in our careers. We're all about 4 or 5 years into a career. We were experienced enough to be able to do the job, but inexperienced enough to be not afraid, not, you know, to be cocky. You know, it was like, yeah, I'm trained to do this. I can do this. I haven't experienced a ton of major disappointment in my career yet. So yeah, this is doable. And we just did it and we fed off each other. That was a wild thing. I was in Texas. The attorneys prosecuting it were in DC. So they're in East Coast time. Most of my team is in California. And so I find myself in this sweet spot where if I got up early enough, I was like answering questions from the attorneys on the East Coast. And if I stayed late enough, I was like supporting guys on the West Coast. And then I would like, you know, I would come back to work at 6 a.m. or open up my laptop or whatever at 10 at night. And I'd have 15 emails from one of my partners on the West Coast. I'd be like, all right, let's go. He found some more leads. And it just like, we fed each other. It was just like this like team dynamic of, oh, you want to go one more? Let's go one more. Okay, let's go one more. Oh, you identified that guy? All right, I'm gonna identify his buddy. Let's find out. And we just dug in. And I think we had at some point, we had to cut it down because like you got to fit all these people into an indictment, right? We indicted, it was an 81-page indictment. I think it was 61 people. And it was like 5 call centers and 56 people, something like that in the US and India, all in a single head strike, one indictment. And we dropped that thing. And we probably left 40 people on the cutting room floor that we could have indicted on individual cases, but they didn't quite fit into the conspiracy. And we continued to knock those people down in the years that followed. But it was really cool. Like we got to finally, after years of fighting and hunting and identifying people in 2016, unfortunately about a week before the election, because this would have probably made a bigger splash and had a bigger impact if we hadn't taken it down when we did. But we ran, I think it was 8 different states. We ran simultaneous search warrants in 8 different states. We hit 25 people at the same time, hooked every single one of them up. Every single one of them pled out. We had so much dirt on all of them by the time we did the head strike, not a single one of them took it to trial. And then the problem became, how do we impact these people who are in India? How do we convince India to bring
them? Were they American citizens?
Somewhere. Yeah, what's it like when you roll up those guys?
When you start rolling them up? Most of them, I think...
Take it.
Like the guy, I hit one guy in particular. His name was, I forget his name, Hardik Patel, I think. I went to his house. I led the team that took down his house in the Chicago suburbs. He's an Indian national. He was working in the call centers over there. He helped like develop the scheme and then decided, you know, I'm going to get out and I'm going to go to the U.S. His wife got like an F-1 student visa and him and his family got to come along. So she goes to school in Chicago. They get the visa. They don't actually go to school. They just arrive in Chicago and just stay. And he starts to like open a liquor store, all that stuff. When I knocked on his door that day, you know, immediately he's, you know, it's like 6 a.m, they're getting the kid ready for school. It was kind of, that kind of sucked because you hate to see when there's kids involved in it. And that guy's doing 15 years in jail now. But I say, hey, we got to talk to you. And these guys all like, they're businessmen, right? They're not like hardened criminals. So they're not guys who have dealt a lot with police. And if they have, it's in India where they're like, you know, paying some bribes and telling them to go away. And he's like, yeah, absolutely. I want to help you, whatever I can do. I don't know anything about this, but you know, I did work in call centers. They immediately start to give you information that they're building that secondary narrative that they can try to figure out a way. They're very smart. They're trying to think, how can I make this seem like, yes, I was tangentially involved, but not involved with the criminal aspect of it. So he starts telling me, yeah, I was in the call centers, but I worked on the good side of call centers. I was in the bad side. I didn't know anything that was going on. I was just a business manager, blah, blah, blah. Well, fortunately, like I said, I had seized over 200 email accounts via search warrant, and including one of his, I think at least one of his, but I had an email in my folder. I just pulled it out, slid across the table. I was like, do me a favor. I let him talk for about 35 minutes and just tell me his story. I was like, do me a favor and read this email. And he sat there and he read it. And the email was him directing a guy to hit as many people as you can. It's the end of the month. We got to hit our numbers. You got to do X, Y, and Z, da, 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 da. Max them out. Tell them the police are coming. Like everything, like just right there in black and white. Like directing a guy to do the thing that we're investigating. And I'm like, as he's done reading, he kind of looks up at me, he's like, Ashen. I was like, listen, like, you understand that, like, lying to a federal agent is another charge. So do you want to try again? He was like, just broke, just defeated. And then for the next, like, 45 minutes, he's just telling me the whole story. And that was typically it.
He does give up, like, more information and...
Yeah, yeah. No, I got a full confession from him. And most of our guys, we got a full confession. And then what ended up happening, because most of these guys at the time that you're booking them. Like, I mean, you see it like on TV. It's like, you know, it's like, oh, I've been staring at your face for, you know, 3 years, you know, like, tell me everything you know, or blah, blah, blah. It's like that sort of stuff. That doesn't work. Like, you have to treat people with respect. You have to sit down across from them, recognize, like, this guy's going to lie. He's going to try to spin. Let him spin. Let him tell his version of events, and then just gently correct him and let him know, like, this isn't going anywhere, bud. You know, like, you got two ways to do this. You can come clean, or you can take this trial, but I'm going to win. And when I win, the difference is going to be the amount of years of your life you lose. Do you want to lose more because you took it to trial and you wasted my time and the government's money? Or do you want to get on Team USA and help us bring down some other guys and get some of your life back? And that's really it. So,
what about the ones you snatch overseas?
We only got one overseas, and that's kind of the big...
It's hard.
Yeah, that's the part that hurts. That's the part that hurts because they're still out there. I've not been to India, so this isn't meant as a dig on India. But they don't have a federal law enforcement set up the way that we do. They have their, I think it's GBI or something. I forget what it's called. It's their version of the FBI. They're not really a law enforcement agency in the same way that our law enforcement agencies operate. They're more of like they tell the locals what to do, right? So, but the locals, a lot of them are bought off by the call centers. Call centers are big money operations. They're like paying the piso. So when we sent over a red notice and we got Interpol involved and we said, hey, we've got warrants for all these guys. We know they live here. This is where they are. I've got, you know, visa information. I've got all this stuff. Go out and get them. Interpol can hand that over to the Indian government and the Indian government can disseminate it out to the locals and the locals can say, we can't find them. We don't know. You know.
Well,
so we have extradition treaties, but it doesn't mean they're going to be executed. So the one guy we did get, we actually... After all of our guys domestically, so I've still got like 30 warrants outstanding in India for these guys. And so they're basically sentenced to life in India because if they travel outside of India, Interpol will snag them.
So their visas are tracked and passports or whatever are tracked?
Yes and no. I mean, like, so it depends on the country, like the relationship you have with the country and what, you know, data sharing arrangements are. But by and large, we can have an extradition treaty with a country. We can't force them to extradite. Like I tell a story about a guy down in Brownsville who was an Indian national. He was a professor at the University of Texas, Brownsville, and he murdered his girlfriend. You remember this story?
Gosh.
Yeah. So he murdered his girlfriend, buried her on the beach out at South Padre Island.
Oh my gosh.
Well, he gets convicted of second degree manslaughter. He's in the courtroom. The judge's name was Lemus, and the judge is the state court. The judge was taking bribes, and he was taking bribes from a lot of people. He's in jail too. Tell me about the Rio Grande. I'll tell you some stories about the Rio Grande Valley. but Judge Lemus takes a bribe from this guy's attorney to let him out after he's been convicted, to let him get his affairs in order before he reports to his like 20-year prison sentence and, you know, TDCJ. Well, of course, naturally, the guy says, I'm not going up to Huntsville or wherever. I'm going to get on a plane and go back to Bombay or wherever I'm going. Took us 7 years, a convicted murderer, took 7 years for the government of India to honor the extradition request and send them back. So our people who were involved in nonviolent crimes, they're probably never going to see the inside of an American jail cell, but they're never going to be able to travel around the outside of the country, because if they do, we've got better relationships with other countries that will extradite, and we'll just reach out and snag them. So,
what's the beautiful thing about living in America? We actually have Americans who want to go do that. And then we have Americans who just want to serve. Even if they don't want to do that job, they'll still go do it for you, and swiftly. That doesn't exist everywhere else. It's a pretty amazing place to live. I have that.
It is. Yeah, we got one guy. The guy that we got was fortunately the godfather of the whole thing. He was like their El Chapo, right? He's got to develop the IRS scam. If anybody listening to this ever got a telephone call from the quote-unquote IRS between, say, about 2012 and 2017, this guy was directly responsible for it. Every dollar of fraud that these guys stole, he was responsible for it. We were able to arrest him. We arrested him in Singapore. After my guys got sentenced here in the U.S. So we arrested everybody in 2016, about a week before the election. It took until about 2018, I think, for everybody to be sentenced. And then this guy popped his head up again. He's overseas. He's like, okay. They got named and shamed in the indictment. His name's out there. The Indian government knows he's out there. And this was kind of the reason why we did it this way. We expected most of our people in India wouldn't get extradited. But we said, if we name all of them and we do a speaking indictment, 81-page indictment describing everything that they did, everything we've got on them, India may not turn them over to us, but they'll bleed them dry. Like, they have, like, officials going and saying, oh, you don't want to go to America? Pay up.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
This is not evaluated by the FDA, not intended for diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
And this guy got sick and tired of getting hit up by, like, local authorities and cops to, like, pay him protection money, essentially. And he decided he was going to go open some bank accounts in Singapore. So he gets on a plane. He flies over to Singapore. He opens up some bank accounts. Interpol lets us know. They say, hey, this guy popped in. He's only there for, like, 24 hours. And that's, you know, halfway around the world. So by the time all the communication goes back and forth, you know, different time zones, different, you know, all that stuff, he's already gone. He's back to India. But we know he's got bank accounts there, so he's going to come back. And when he came back in September, like, of 2018, I think.
2019. We were about to travel to go get Leanna.
Yeah.
You went, we were going.
Well, he came, he got arrested in 2018. I went and got him.
He went and got him in 2019.
So yeah. he got hooked up by the Singapore authorities, and they threw him in jail there. And we went back and forth for about 6 months to actually get him extradited. My team and I got on a plane. We flew to Singapore, picked him up, brought him home, and he's doing over 20 years.
What are these guys living like? Is it like whatever American thinks they're living like? How they got private jets and Lamborghinis and stuff like that? Are these guys? It is okay. Check.
Yeah. Like, one of the guys, you can look this guy up. His nickname is Shaggy. I indicted him. His real name is Sagar Thacker. The Indian authorities actually arrested him. They shook him down pretty good. We wanted to put our hands on him. He had flown to Dubai after our indictment, and we don't have a UAE. We don't have a treaty with them for extradition, so we're trying to figure something out. And the Indian authorities basically said, "Hey, listen, the Americans are trying to get you. Like, you come back to India, we'll treat you better." And so he flew back, and they hooked him up. But he had bought his Audi A4. It was one of, like, only, like, a handful in the world, from the captain of the Indian cricket team. And if you think about, like, the captain of the Indian cricket team is, like, you know, name the most popular athlete, you know, LeBron James,
that's
or whatever,
the thing,
right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's their deal.
That's their thing. So, like, that's the kind of money that he had, was that he could, like, hobnob with Bollywood and hobnob with, like, you know, the Indian cricket team.
And here he's stealing from our grandmas.
That's how he got
rich.
What
do they say they do?
They say they're businessmen. They run call centers. Yeah. Yeah. A lot of them do debt collection.
Businessmen are great about doing that.
Yeah.
What do you do?
Yeah.
I'm an entrepreneur.
I'm an entrepreneur.
Yeah, but a lot of them say they're in tech. And a lot of them do have tech degrees. A lot of them, like, India has a fantastic like college system. It's like they've got a bunch of MITs over there, right? Yeah. So they have really, really smart people coming out of
the systems.
I feel like
they're great with the number systems and how and doing all that.
They are, yeah. They're excellent. So,
and
yeah.
Not that all Indians are bad.
No, not at all. In fact,
this is an amazing kind of conundrum, right? Because they're not, technically, they're over the phone. They're just voicing this into you.
Right.
That's right. And people are doing it.
Yeah.
So you probably in the back of their head, they're like, hey, look, I didn't force you to do anything.
And that's the thing. So this is like U.S. law, you know, fraud is illegal. Not every country. It is. Like a lot of countries look at it as like, you know, like.
That's where I'm going with that.
Exactly. Yeah.
Some places like, hey, big boy rules.
Exactly. So there's no corresponding law in the books over there for wire fraud or mail fraud or whatever. It's just like, you know, sucker couldn't hold on to his money. You know, so it's your own fault. And that's kind of the
some
attitude.
Slick stuff.
It is.
I mean,
right?
When you're just talking about, we're not about force, about weaponry. Intimidation in person is even different.
Right, right.
Even then, I can understand that. I'm like, hey, man, if you forcefully in front of them intimidated them out of there, that's a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But we're talking about 1,000 miles away over a phone.
Right, right.
Their mindset.
They're telling our grandparents.
I get that. I'm not sticking up for them. I'm just saying their mindset has to be that way.
I get what
you're
saying.
They don't even care. Why would they care?
And I'm gonna agree, I'm gonna take it a step further. So what you said, like, not obviously not all Indians are bad, right? Like the more I worked on this case, the more respect I had for the people in this country who are hardworking immigrants from India, because there's a ton of them. I mean, Houston area, they're everywhere, right? Like, I'm gonna go up to the corner store up here, we're going to see guys from Gujarat. A lot of them are from Gujarat, which is part of India. If you hear the last name Patel, a lot of that is from Gujarat. And that in
is
the
that
traditional, it's a last name that's kind of associated with the traditional caste system over there, the merchant caste.
Okay, check. So it means something.
It means something. So if you're a Patel, like most of your hotel owners here, it's referred to as the Patel Hotel Cartel in the U.S. Like most of your like independent hotel owners, restaurant owners, 7-Eleven owners, whatever, a lot of those folks are from the same part of India that these scammers are from. So they're very industrious, hardworking people. They just chose a profession that's, you know, on the other side of the line.
On
right?
the other side of it, yeah.
But I respect the hell out of like the ingenuity. I respect the hell out of the hard work. Like they were to me, these were people that were worthy opponents. It was like, for me, it's like, I'm going up against some smart, hardworking, industrious people. My team is smart, hardworking, industrious. Let's see who wins. You know, and that's how I looked at it. It was just
you
like
you can talk somebody, an American, out of their money.
Yeah, $300 million.
I mean, think about that.
Our grandparents' retirement money. Like this is all of the money they have left. They're not able to go back to work and earn more money. This is what they've got saved up to get them through the rest of their life on Earth.
The hardest victim I ever had, and this is one. So after this case, this was called Operation Outsource. We took that case down, and then a couple years later, I worked with one of your fraternity brothers on another version of it, and that's kind of the one that we spun up. A victim that we had in that case. This one almost makes me cry when I talk about it. She lost $2 million. She was 82 years old, lived in Florida. She was a retired teacher. She had saved every dime she'd ever made. No kids, no husband, lived alone, lost every dollar of it. She ended up having to sell her house that she owned outright, basically to make ends meet, because she didn't have any backup. She lost everything. And they scammed her over a period of 6 or 7 months. The entire time she thought, I'm helping the federal government, who's calling me, uncover the bad guys behind this by continuing to go along. She basically thought she was an undercover agent. She thought she was like a CI. Lost every dollar.
Turned her.
Yeah. They turned. Well, I mean, she, and that happens a lot too. So that's on these, like, you know, jumping to a different scam. Like the thing you were talking about, the grandson in jail scam. Romance scams are very similarly run. A lot of those are run out of West Africa or Jamaica. That's a lot of times we'll see a, you know, hey, I'm a serviceman overseas and I'm stranded over here. I'm whatever.
Oh,
can
we
you
get
help
that
out,
right?
Guys
all
pull
the
those
time.
Secret agent moves and turn the asset into a.
And they turn them into
how
a money
that?
Launderer.
They yeah. say they're Marcus. Yeah. Some of them say that they're Marcus. I can't tell you how many times I've gotten a message saying, your husband and I have been talking for months, and I've even been sending him money. And I'm like, what are you talking about? I said, I'm so sorry, but you've been scammed. My husband doesn't look
I'm looking at
any-
his broke down ass out in the freaking yard right now.
He's not corresponding with you.
He's on the mower.
He's like, I'm looking at him right now. I know exactly where he's at.
He's on the mower and he's not
back in the day we might have had a lot of fun, but yeah, not now.
What happens a lot with those is that they'll be like a widow or a widower, right? Uh-huh. And a lot of times what happens, and this is something where, like, you know, like Lacey's mom or like people that are single at that age, they go online, they decide like, hey, I'm going to, you know, get back out there, and they maybe put themselves in, you know, a dating app. And there's scammers all over those things too. If you're listening to this and you got parents of that age, or, you know, widows, widowers, take care of your parents. Make sure you know what they're doing online, because it's probably more dangerous that your parents are online than your kids, because your kids actually know a little bit about the environment they're operating in. Your parents often don't. And what ends up happening is they'll get someone like that, like, hey, you know, I need to get some money out of Syria. You know, can you help me get this money into a bank account? And they basically turn your grandparents into money mules. And they get them opening up bank accounts. And what would we do? We'd go and knock on somebody's door down in, you know, Conroe or whatever, and be some old lady living alone. Like, man, you opened up 15 bank accounts this year. You know, we got all sorts of reports from victims sending you money and you moving money. Do you understand what's happening here? They have no idea. They're like, no, I'm helping so-and-so. He's stuck overseas. He's just trying to get money back over to the U.S. And you know, you start asking critical, have you ever FaceTimed this person? Have you ever met them in person? No, it's all been on the internet. Where'd you meet him? Oh, on Plenty of Fish or on, you know, whatever dating app. Yeah. So,
well, think about the movies and all the TV shows and how our generation had to operate anyways.
Yeah.
So they know where that exists.
Our generation created the internet.
You know what I'm talking about? And plus developing an asset and stuff like that. So yeah. if they know that exists, and someone actually calls them up, it's like, hey, look, your government needs you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you need?
We actually do that for real.
Right, right, right.
Yeah. You know, so why wouldn't they even anticipate that, especially when they're older and they're alone?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
People, that changes. That's a game changer when they're alone, man, because then you got somebody, and those guys are so slick at talking that you just be like, oh, yeah, yeah.
I made more arrests during the pandemic during 2020 than probably any other year of my career, because these guys were so active because they were preying on the elderly folks. And so it was just, you know, me and my guys were just out there like all over. These guys would go, the runners would go around the country. So they might like vacate money up in, you say, Madison, Wisconsin, then Chicago, and then whatever. And they spend a couple days in one spot and they travel around.
So they say which one works better. Is it individually dependent? Say the forceful entry saying, hey, you need this. I'm a police officer. I need the money. Or the guy's like, hey, look, I need, you know.
It depends on the scam, but yeah,
I guess they just know.
Yeah, yeah. Like the IRS scam was very effective, but because we took it down, they don't do that anymore. Everyone's afraid of the IRS, right? Like you hear IRS, and like you know, like especially this time of year. Like this time of year, IRS is when they're like hammering people, but they're not really running that anymore. And they found that the SSA scam was more effective, because what are our retired people most scared of? You know, like my Social Security number getting compromised. That's everything to me. And so they prey on the elderly. So that's really where it shifted to like being a more elderly victim base. And that to me is just like, there aren't enough years in jail for these people.
It's so wrong to prey after our elderly and our children. Like, you can't do that.
18 to 37. Free game.
Yeah.
Free game.
Give us
or 40, right?
Yeah. Give free us a battle.
Game. I mean, like, we have time to recover.
Come on,
when
y'all.
We make mistakes.
I mean, even the bad guys, let's all just get together and just come to this common agreement that if you're in the game window in that age rank, you're fair game, right? If you're outside of that,
well, I
take
mean,
care of our kids and
like
our elderly.
I know more than the average person because I lived with this for like a really long time. And we were in Florida. You're laughing.
Yeah.
We were in Florida. We bought our condo and it came with a bunch of furniture that we didn't want. I was like, I'm going to sell this on the marketplace. I was scammed inside of 15 minutes and it was so good. It took me 3 messages to go, wait a minute. And I got hot. I started sweating. I looked at him. I said, I think I just made a mistake. And I ended up having to shut down.
Full of scams.
I had to shut down my PayPal. I had to shut down my Venmo. And I had to put tracking on my business account because I was like, oh, crap. Like, and it happened so quickly. And it was so believable what they said to me. They were like, hey, we're going to, like, my brother's going to come pick this up at 2:00. And then
it was basically an advance fee for us.
Yeah, they sent me an email that was from PayPal to click and pay, but that click and pay was just getting my information. So it was just opening you up so that it happened so quickly, inside of 15 minutes. Like, it's so sophisticated.
You post anything on Marketplace.
And I know more than most people, and it happened so fast. I was, and again, I was embarrassed. I was like, I think I made a mistake.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it's brutal. I mean, and I look at it as, I've still got buddies who are out there doing this, who are still, you know, working these. I'm no longer with the government, but like, I've got buddies who are still working this stuff, and we still don't have a ton of funding for this stuff. There's a permanent Senate subcommittee. I think it's like the Senate subcommittee on aging, and they are heavily involved in this because their focal point is, how do we protect American seniors? But that's about it. I mean, it's like five senators. There's not like a lot of action. When Bill Barr was attorney general, when we took our case down, I think it was, Obama's, I forget her name, Loretta Lynch, maybe? Yeah, Loretta Lynch. She was the AG, I think, at the time. Yeah. She was the AG at the time, and she was outgoing. I mean, she was outgoing like a couple months later. Jeff Sessions came in, and he took an interest in this, and he had done a lot with seniors. But it wasn't until Bill Barr came in that we got the first elder fraud strike forces set up around the country, and we got like six of them. And we got one here in Southern District, Texas. We got one in Middle District, Florida, Arizona, I think, Southern California, wherever like elderly populations were. We didn't get a lot of money for it, but we got like dedicated AUSAs from the U.S. Attorney's Office, and we got all the agencies together, and we said, okay, let's get a guy from IRS-CI, let's get a guy from Secret Service, let's get the guys from the IGs, let's get the guys from wherever, Treasury, wherever, and we'll put them in a room together, and they'll work these cases together. And they started to create these task forces, but that was that was 6 years after I started investigating this, before the federal government started putting assets and resources into it. So it takes a long time. And again, it comes down to these cases. Like, if you can arrest bad guys, you can knock down runners, but you can't really necessarily reach out and touch people in India, and you're not grabbing a bunch of cash. You're not bringing a bunch of cash back to the government. So it really has to be, in my opinion, the seniors standing up and saying, like, we're becoming victimized by this. Like, do something to help us. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, I mean, it's guys who give a shit. I mean, going out there and following through and investigating these things and having the patience to do it.
So how do we fix that? When the seniors get to a certain age, we lock their accounts in, they can't do that?
Truly, I mean,
because there's preachers that can get them their money like that too.
No, I've worked like in the private sector since leaving the government. I've done conservatorship abuse cases as a private investigator, where I have helped individuals who, you know, a trusted family member is monitoring their finances, and then they steal from them. So we need stronger laws against. We just need stronger laws against elder abuse. I mean, that's the biggest thing, and we need our banking systems to be more reflective of that sort of fraud. Because right now, all the alerts, all the triggers, and our like anti-money laundering systems and banks are really set up for identifying drug trafficking going through banks, right? Human trafficking, cash flowing in those sort of things. That's what pattern recognition is looking at. We need more on elder fraud.
That's a great point. I'm going to shift this pressure over to the banks.
Yeah, for sure.
Y'all should be the ones that should be monitoring this. There's always a focal point. It seems to be the bank.
Always.
If an 80-year-old woman is going and pulling out
$20,000 on the cell phone, because they don't let them get off the phone during it.
What, the banker's like, fine.
Well, you figure the person behind the counter, right? They're making $15 an hour. Like, they're, you know, like.
Yeah, but there's a manager back there.
Somewhere, yeah. But, you know, like, we shut down the gift card companies in large part. Well, not, we didn't shut them down, but we put them in a situation where we said, listen, like, you're going to get regulated if you don't do something about this. Because those are like, you probably did this for Hunter when he was in college, right? You put like some cash on one of those like Green Dot cards or whatever, and mm-hmm. say, hey, you got $1,000. Here's your cash. They were using those as instruments to launder the money from these scammers. And Walmart and Target and some of these other folks, they started putting signs on their registers at customer service, like, do not, you know, this is a, like basically warning them of, and they started training their, you know, their 11-year-old employee to like, to recognize when somebody's being scammed. And that was effective. We can do that with the banks too.
So I was going to ask you, so what's the answer to this? Can we take this into the schools? Can you teach kids at a young age, say, hey, as you get older, they're going to people who are going to try, and I think that would be a valuable lesson to teach high schoolers.
For sure, yeah.
Because it's going to come into play throughout your life.
I mean, stuff like this makes a huge difference, right? Like getting on podcasts and actually talking about it where audiences are going to listen, telling people, if you're listening now, share this with your seniors, share this with your kids.
Yeah.
Listen to what's going on out there and be aware. And it's really situational awareness. It's online situational awareness. We all live in a world where we're broadcasting our lives like so much that there are so many indicators. I mean, like, just think about OPSEC. Like, there's so many indicators you put out on a daily basis about your environment, about who you are, about your kids' names, about what you have, that somebody can exploit. And it's, I mean, for folks like us who have like an online presence because we have businesses, you know, we're always trying to be conscious of that and aware of that. Like, how much am I giving away because I have to create a situation where people know, like, and trust me? And how much of that is putting me in peril? And it's weighing that. But for our seniors, for people on Facebook in particular, that, like, stay off the marketplace. Mm-hmm. Tell your parents to stay off the marketplace. Don't list your car on there. Don't try to buy anything on there.
Facebook Marketplace is like an eBay kind of for Facebook for local people.
Oh. Yeah, I mean, it's just crawling with scams. Mm-hmm. And that's it. I mean, it really is like. We're very conscious of, you know, I'm very conscious of what my parents are doing online. She's very conscious of what her mom's doing online. We're probably rare in that regard. Like, a lot of people, like, it's the Wild West out there, and your parents are like, you know.
we are too.
Oh, once my mother got it, there's a bull sitting out in my pasture out there, bro.
She's
almost 2,000 pounds.
Bought that on Marketplace.
It was there when I showed up.
She's always.
You can't believe what she can get on that phone.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's funny. But yeah.
Love you, Mom.
Yeah, we're definitely. My mom she freaking loves TikTok because she watches the cooking stuff and the gardening stuff. And it's like, that's the algorithm that's just feeding her. And she'll send me stuff. I'm like, I'm not opening the TikTok. I'm just not doing
it. So how about that?
Yeah, I'm not.
I mean, what has TikTok in that taught us that humans have an algorithm?
Oh, we absolutely
do.
This is maybe the more
individual human has their algorithm programmed into that sucker, and that phone can find it.
Oh yeah, and that, I mean, obviously y'all know about like TikTok, and I think that, you know, that just passed the House. I don't know where it is with the Senate or with the President, but you know, that divestment of the CCP. But I mean, like, the second that came out, I told her, I was like, I know everyone in your industry is going to be on TikTok.
I don't have it.
Don't do it.
I had it on a separate phone. So my old phone that doesn't have any of our apps, I was using that and I was on TikTok. And I did TikTok for about a year. And I had some people find me, but I didn't want to put it on my main phone and it got too hard to go. So, I mean, my business has been based on Instagram for 7 years. Sure, so
man. The only things that go TikTok are time bombs. You know what I mean? And that thing, what it does, it just.
It's so smart.
There's other ones out there.
It's so smart.
I'm wondering sometimes with the tech guys when they were just like, it's an algorithm problem. I was like, oh, so that thing's learning.
Yeah.
It is.
So you're telling, that means you don't know.
Yeah.
Otherwise you tell us, because our smart kids, the nerds, usually when you bust them, they'll fess up.
Yeah.
They'll kind of straight up you, man. They can be the meanest sometimes, but when you bottom line, and then you just look at their faces. Mm-hmm. Like sometimes they got this look on their face like, hey man, I think this thing just kind of takes control. We don't have an answer for that.
It has a, I will say, I mean, I've been in, I haven't had an Instagram business for 7 years. When I was on TikTok for a brief period of time, it has an uncanny way to keep you on for longer that the other apps don't have. Like, they're addictive. The addictive quality to it is much higher. It was one of those things like where I would notice, it'd be like, wow, I just lost an hour of my life, and I'm not somebody that typically does that. And it takes you down, and they will take you down rabbit holes to see, like, it will throw something. They don't really do this on Instagram or Facebook. You can be scrolling through that For You page and it's very predictable about what it's giving you. But then it'll throw something in there to like, that's maybe very far off. And it's gauging to see how you interact with that and how much time you give it. Because even Instagram, it's all about how much time you give it. Mm-hmm. Your ability to go viral, like when you create a reel, is about how much watch time you're going to get. That's the biggest indicator. With TikTok, they'll throw something in there and they want to see how much time you give this really random thing. And if you give it some time, then it, like, if you stop to watch it and you're like, wait, what was that? And you go back to look at it and you watch the whole way through, then it's going to start giving you things because it just learned.
Opens a portal.
You gave that. Mm-hmm. It just opened a portal. So it could be something about a subject that you didn't even know that you were interested in. And all of a sudden, you're taken into that, and then it just gets deeper and deeper and deeper. And I don't see that I don't see that happening on the other applications in the same way. I mean, I always joke, like, I don't really even follow. I follow my clients on Instagram and I follow some close friends, but I don't follow a lot of people. So my feed a lot of times is raccoons and golden doodles. I watch a lot of raccoons and golden doodle footage because that's I enjoy watching animals. That's what it gives me. But I don't ever notice that it throws something completely out of my norm there. Mm-hmm. Whereas on TikTok, there was a time when I would be scrolling it. And like I scrolled it a lot when my dad was really sick. That was one of those, like it was a thing that I would do. And it would take you in like a direction.
You got to train your own algorithm.
And it was, and you would end up, the next day you'd go in there and that direction that it took you, that was the first thing you see. And it has like there's like an indoctrination that's really, that's happening that I don't think is happening on the other apps.
Yeah, it's scary.
Whoever wrote that piece of code, clever.
They're really smart. I mean, anything on social media, they're really smart. I even look at, you know, our two little girls, one that's nonverbal and on the autism spectrum, and then our 11-year-old that's fully neurotypical. The YouTube Kids app, the way it programs to what they want to watch is fascinating. I mean, it learns what your kids like. My youngest will watch Mickey Mouse Clubhouse in like 15 different languages. So all of a sudden she's listening to Mickey Mouse Clubhouse in Russian. But then because she's watching videos in Russian, it might also filter in other Russian cartoons. Mm. It's telling like what our kids are exposed to, what, like all of these things have an algorithm and they're all at some level, they're learning your children.
Which is probably a good thing if you think about it,
if you're checking.
If your parents check, then it's kind of like a report card every day. Let me see that thing.
Yeah. what's popping up?
With my youngest, because of her cognitive disability, I can pretty much know what's on there. My oldest, I mean, there's been a couple of times, she's actually not allowed to have YouTube right now. She doesn't have YouTube. She doesn't have YouTube Kids. You actually asked yesterday because she's learning how to play the ukulele. He was like, can she have YouTube back? And I'm like, I'm going to have to think about that because she took it in a direction. I peeked over her shoulder and I was like, wait a minute. Like, what is this? And it was on YouTube Kids. And so she got that taken away. She can only watch Disney Plus.
Download the app or visit Robinhood.com to learn more. Investing involves risk. Other fees apply. Robinhood Financial LLC is a registered broker-dealer.
It is one of those things I don't think, you know, parents realize, like, how much even those apps that are for kids, like, it is filtering in certain things that you may not even realize. And then when you get them on, I mean, there's kids my daughter's age that are 11 that are on TikTok. That, the 11-year-old mind is very impressionable. My 11-year-old will believe anything.
That's the scam of that generation, of that age group. That is their scam.
They can be radicalized to believe whatever that app. And
that's a drug.
It is a drug.
Back up this conversation the last 15 minutes and pull out the name and the words we're using.
Yes.
Like when I feed on this, this.
Absolutely. Yeah. They can't. Well, I mean, we see this. The strongest, the only thing our 11-year-old gets upset if she's grounded from is her tablet. Mm-hmm. I could take away anything else and she'd be like, meh. But her tablet, that is the linchpin. Because we didn't grow up with, I always tell her, I'm like, you had to wait for your show to come on Friday. And if your dad was watching football, guess what? You weren't watching it because there was only one TV.
No TiVo.
That was it. There was no TiVo. There was none of that. And our children are growing up in a world where I was at Disney World this weekend with my youngest and it was just she and I, and the number of kids that were in their strollers on like a phone or on a screen at an amusement park. Like that's, it's just common, like little kids, like 2 years old. It's just commonplace. And I mean, we have screen time. Like our daughter that's on the spectrum, that is a very regulating thing for her. Like having that tablet is very regulating for her, but we still limit the amount of time that we give them that because it really does. The amount of studying that we're going to be able to do in 20 or 30 years about how these things have altered our brain chemistry.
Oh, sweet.
Like it's because, I mean, I have friends that do, have y'all ever done like neuro mapping?
I haven't.
So it's where like they wear a headband and you're actually watching like a show.
Watching something that shows up on.
And, but there's cues that actually like reprogram the brain. And it's for like, it's a form of trauma therapy. And, but in essence, like if you think about it, like so much of like what we're watching like on these screens is like, it's reprogramming our brains. I always tell my clients, we're walking around in the year 2024 in a prehistoric body. This is the body that was walking around in the 1800s. This body was not designed to be interconnected with people. Our nervous systems were not designed to be interconnected with people all over the world. Mm-hmm. That's, we were not designed to have the amount of connections and input and conversations the way we do right now. It's, and so I think, you know, even like 50 years from now, the studies they do on how brain and behavior has shifted and changed even since, you know, I graduated from college in 2005, like Facebook, I got Facebook my senior year in college. Like since then, like how that has shifted, like how we operate as human beings.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It is.
I didn't have a cell phone until I was a mother. Let's just say that.
Like I have, I mean, I think I got one when I graduated college. So it was like 2001. And it was one of those with like the Nokia brick that you could like, you know, you could drop it.
But that's what you're going back to what he was saying. You've got adults that are in their 60s and 70s that they lived the majority of their lives without that. And so they're playing catch up. My grandmother.
I mean, it's like crack cocaine.
My grandmother has
it's like being in a casino, created, you know,
multiple Facebook accounts and Instagram accounts. She gets locked out of one, gets into the other. People, she's been taken advantage of all the time. She was in her mid-60s when she got a cell phone, like an iPhone. So we've got a whole population of people that lived their majority of their lives without this drug, and now they have it. And it's complete, like, our younger ones, the way their brains are equipped to handle it is going to be different than older people. It's just, I mean, I'm sure there's studies on this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's so different.
It's crazy. So once you busted all of the scams, what happened with that? Did you leave law enforcement at that time?
So we took down the big case. We took down Operation Outsource in 2016, and then it took another about 4 years total to get it through the court process, right? So it's a federal government. Nothing moves like super quick, but by federal government standards for a case that large, it moved pretty darn quick. And after that, I continued. But 2020, I left the federal government in large part because my father-in-law got sick. And I had been very fortunate to have a wife who dropped everything for me on more than one occasion. Like we moved from Harlingen up to San Antonio. She had to shut down a business to do that and for us to make that move because it was for my career. And then we did it again when we came over here. So, so I figured it was kind of my turn. And we had a situation where it was kind of a perfect storm situation. We had a lot of changes happening with the new administration coming in, and investigative priorities were changing in my agency. And I was going to be on the road a lot. I was going to be spending a lot of time in Louisiana. I was going to be spending a lot of time in Lafayette doing CARES Act cases and COVID fraud and things like that, because the prison system over there was kind of like a hive for that sort of fraud, strangely enough. So I realized I was going to be on the road a lot. And then her dad got a stage 4 terminal cancer diagnosis. And we were basically told you got anywhere from a year to 3 years with palliative chemotherapy. So like our best case scenario, 12 to 36 months. And I realized that with her business, she's running a very successful consulting business. We have 2 special needs children. I'm on the road all the time for work. Something's got to give here. We can't keep all these plates spinning. And so it was, you know, it was a conversation we had, but it was like, listen, she's, you know, at that point, she had really, like, her salary had overtaken mine to the point where mine was kind of like negotiable. And so we kind of put ourselves in a room and we said, this is my opportunity to be the teammate that you need right now. And so I stepped into a role of kind of being a full-time caregiver to our children so that she could spend as much time as possible with her father, manage her business. Our kids would still have the care that they needed. And it was basically, people give 2 weeks notice. I had to give 6 months because I had so many like open cases and things going on that I had to wind down. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to make sure they got across the finish line the right way. I wanted to leave things on people's desks with a bow on it. Like, I drove things down to the 99-yard line. And I was like, here you go. Like, all you got to do is this, this, and this, execute this, and you've got an arrest. You've got a stat. And it's funny. It's like, I left in February of 2022. And 2 years later, I'm still getting like cases that I had worked on. I'm still getting notified by like friends saying, hey, we finally arrested that fugitive. And, you know, I'm like, I continued to win awards for cases until like December of last year. Like, I was still getting called into the U.S. Attorney's Office to win awards. So it takes a long time for these things to wind down. But that's when I shifted largely into, I started doing the podcast. I started writing. I started doing public speaking. I said, like, how can I be an asset to this family in a different way? How can I take the experiences and the things I did in my life and put them into, you know, allow myself to be a father first and be that what the team needs right now first, while at the same time being a contributing member of the family? And so, you know, we basically sat down and we made that decision, and that's kind of been my role for the last couple of years. And it hasn't been easy for her. I mean, she's like, the two of us really, I think probably the biggest, we've done a lot together. We've crossed how many Ironman finish lines together? I don't know.
Five.
Well, together. I think we've done three together.
Three together, or four together. Yeah,
on
the same day.
Like, yeah. So we've each
That's
done.
That's date night?
Yeah, yeah. It used to be.
Before kids, it was actually.
Yeah, we used to put on like Game of Thrones and like watch like four episodes on the bike.
That's what we,
On the bike.
We would be on a bike trainer and watching Game of Thrones.
Yeah, we'd ride like a 60-mile ride and watch like three episodes of Game of Thrones. But pre-kids, but yeah.
Yeah, we don't do that anymore. It was 7 years ago yesterday that I crossed my last Ironman finish line. I've never ridden a bike since.
Oh my gosh,
that's crazy. Was one of you a good runner, one swimmer, one bike? Did
Both of us are good runners.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
We started as runners.
Like, we came to it from running. So like in the midst of this case that I was working on, it was a lot of stress. And then there was another thing going on where I like actually busted my special agent in charge doing something really stupid and ended up putting him in jail. and the time that was all going on was very stressful in my career because I was putting my boss in jail. And so I started running. I started doing marathons. And she was like, we were getting married. And it was like when we were still engaged. And we ran our first half marathon together. And then we just started doing that together. We'd go for runs together. That became our, instead of Friday night or Saturday night dates, we would go on Sunday morning for a long run. We'd do like a 15-mile or 20-mile run.
Y'all talk or just run?
Oh, we talk.
Oh, we talk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're talking about like there's...
Yeah, I mean...
Like, our long, slow runs, yeah. But like when we got on the course, like she was brutal. Like if we ran a marathon in Las Vegas together.
I'm a little competitive.
Like we ran the marathon at night in Las Vegas, and she was like having a hard time. I felt good, and she was like not feeling great. And like I stayed with her, but like a month later, we ran San Antonio Rock and Roll Marathon together.
He was struggling like, mile 16.
I was struggling. Like I got cramps mile 16. She just left me. Like, it's the only time she's ever beaten me in a race. She was just like,
and I was excited.
What did you say? Your leg hurts?
Later.
Like, I am not waiting for you. My time is looking good.
But yeah, I did my first Ironman in 2013. Ironman Texas, Lake Woodlands. I mean,
and then I did one 6 months later.
Y'all know
later.
How lovely that water is. And then she did her first in Cozumel 6 months later, and we just kind of did that. But we'd done some hard things together. I think the hardest thing we ever did together was what we did in 2022 and like end of life care for your father.
I would have said it was the adoptions before that.
Maybe you're right. Yeah, maybe you're right. But
the year 2022, when my dad was sick and running the business and him just like, we had no plan. We look back at now, we're like, how dumb were we? Like we felt it had to happen, and it had to happen so quickly that we really didn't have a plan. I was like, we'll figure this out. It's going to be fine. And I think, you know, it was one of those, my dad was so, he stopped care in June of 2022, and that summer everything was kind of winding down. I mean, he like my I hit the biggest milestone I'd ever hit in business. And 36 hours later, my dad died. Mm. It was awful. And it was, you know, it happened right before the holidays. We kind of...
That's when it does.
It's like right... And so we woke up. It's like we got through the holidays and we were kind of like sleepwalking through life. We woke up in January of last year and we were like, we just lost an entire year of our lives because we were taking care of my parents. And we realized we have a daughter that needs to have major surgery. We're in a two-story house. We can't live in this two-story house. We have, so we moved. And so we've had a scenario over the last couple of years where there's been many times where he's come to me and he's like, is it ever going to be calm? And I'm like, I don't know.
I think that's the strength of it. And like what I get from it is, I mean, you can say like, you know, whatever your faith tradition is, but like, you know, we're Christians and like, and I tend to think that a lot of the things I did in my life that led up to that really set us up to have a reservoir and a well of experiences that would put us in a position to be successful at the hardest time, right? Like God did a good job of prepping us like, and putting us in a position to be successful in the hardest moments of our lives. And, you know, when you do things, when you have voluntary adversity in your life, when you introduce voluntary adversity throughout your life, you will always have a well of experiences that you can draw from that are going to make you stronger when the adversity is involuntary. And you can always go back to, I finished six damn Ironmans. I finished how many ultra marathons? That's always there. I made the biggest telefraud case in U.S. history. Like, you put yourself in positions where it's going to suck. And then you overcome the suck. And then when things suck, you're like, this ain't so bad, right? And that kind of, and it's weird, like, because we've talked a lot about this, like, I feel like we were particularly well-built for adoption, you know, based on what we did as single people, you know, as a married couple, but as, like, non-child having people really set us up well to be parents to special needs children, to go through the international adoption process. And I joke with Lacey about this, we talk about it, but I feel like every time I come up with, yeah, we were dealing with this week. Like, we think we're going in the direction we need to be going in, and God reminds us, like, you're not in charge. Yeah,
we've
here,
really
you know?
Had to. There's been many times that we've had to just, we think that we know where we're going, and there's always a huge sign. I mean, even with our second daughter, we had two failed adoptions. I was here when I got a call that our, like, one of our adoptions, I was here. I was training you guys.
Yeah, I remember that.
And it was, there were two different times when things didn't work out. The second time, I actually, like, Renee called me and we were on the phone and I told her how I was feeling and I told her, I said something and she said something back to me and it was the exact same thing that I had read on a bumper sticker 30 minutes before that I was like, this is exactly what I'm feeling. And I went home and I told him, I said, I don't think that this adoption, the direction we're going, is going to work. I think we're going to have to shift. Like, this is not right. It was like a Friday morning and we called our adoption agency and they're like, yeah, we didn't have the heart to tell you, like, I don't think this is actually going to move forward. And it wasn't 2 days later that Leanna's file dropped on our desk. Mm. And it was like we instantaneously knew. And even getting to her, we had so many stops and starts. And everybody told us, you've got to wait. You just stopped this one. You've got to wait. Give it some time. And I was like, nope, we're going. If we had even paused for a couple of weeks, she wouldn't have come home before the pandemic. She would still be in China. She was 6 and a half when we got her. She's 11 now. If we had even faltered, if I had listened to my parents, his parents, everybody that was telling us slow down, we wouldn't have been one of those last couple of groups to travel in 2019, and she would still be in China. We would still be waiting to go get her. She wouldn't have come home. She would have lost another 5 years of her life.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Well, y'all definitely have the story of overcome through struggle and making the best of it. I mean, that's crazy. Through marriage, through children, through work, all of it is just...
What's one of your best takeaways from it?
Embracing struggle.
My best takeaway you know, I think it really comes down to life is relentless. It's never going to, never, ever, ever, ever going to let up. You're going to wake up every morning and there's going to be good days, there's going to be bad days, but there's always going to be something ready to punch you in the face. And you have to be the kind of person, you have to train your mind to be able to take those punches. And for me, like, I've always been a fan since, you know, college of the philosophy of Stoicism. You know, my other favorite Marcus Aurelius, like, you
know, his books are trapped by my chair.
Yeah, exactly. Meditations, I take it with me everywhere. It literally goes with me every time I travel. And I drink deeply from that wisdom because it reminds me that, you know, it's not what happens to you. It's how you react, right? You have the power in your mind. You it's the dichotomy of control. It's that idea of, you know, life isn't what happens, it's what you do with what happens. It's your attitude, it's your reactions, it's your actions. It's how you get back up when you get knocked down. And again, for me, the biggest takeaway is creating a well of experiences through voluntary adversity is going to serve you so well when life does what life does, when it punches you in the face. Like, and it's going to punch hard and often.
I'm totally different. I'm the best thing I ever did amongst all of the things we've gone through is learn the power of regulating my nervous system. I'm like the deeper in tune, the mind follows the body, and the more deep in tune I am with what my body is feeling and the state of my nervous system, the more I am in control of where I go next. And it's just created a deep sense of like understanding and how I react in each moment. And no matter what comes at us, I have the ability to like check in with myself and just ask like, what do I need? Like, what is my body telling me? What do I need? What do I need to consider? And the answer always comes so much easier. You know, we kind of blend those two. Like he's a lot about the mindset. I'm a lot about listening to your body. You know, creating a toolbox of nervous system tools has changed my life and made handling all of the things that I handle every single day and all of the twists and turns with having special needs children like we do so much easier.
Well, that's why y'all are the perfect team.
We were Team Healy for a lot of years.
We have been Team Healy. Yeah. That's our LLC.
That was our, yeah, it's our business.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How funny. Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
It's been that way since we were coaching runners in Harlingen, Texas, you know, 12, 15 years ago. So, yeah.
I love it.
Well, once I figured out that part, I'm like, she obviously has a bunch of gifts that I don't have. And then when those problems presented themselves and I was trying to work through it and just about to lose it, and then they can come up and just kind of solve it. First couple of times you think it's an ego thing. Like, you know, what? I could have done that, whatever, right? Then, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Because what boils up inside of us, too.
Oh, yeah.
We always forget that part. You know, we never talk about that part, right?
No.
But it's great having them, for sure.
I think, like, one thing that Lacey's so great at that, you know, she's done somatic experiencing work. She's taken courses in that. She's becoming a practitioner of that. And, you know, it holds up a mirror to me sometimes when, like, she, you know, because I get very stubborn about things and, like, I don't recognize and understand when it's like, hey, man, like, you got to go for a walk and, like, you know, like, you got to shake this out. You got to do something. It's because I'm so, like, again, it's that meme from, you know, from True Detective. It's like, I'm going to solve this problem. I'm going to bang my head against this wall until I break through it. And, you know, she'll hold a mirror up to me and be like, hey, you're kind of getting, like, beyond the, you need to bring it back in, you need to rein it in.
You're out of your window of tolerance.
Bingo. Yeah, see, she knows the woo-woo way to say it that I don't know, but it's...
Ooh, big words. Yeah. You know what I'm talking about? That even makes it worse sometimes for us.
Yeah, like, that made it worse.
Now they got to throw the big words at us.
You're outside
right?
of your window of tolerance.
So, yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah.
All right, how we deal with that, too.
So, to wrap it all up, I didn't realize we've actually... we're on our second hour.
Wow.
Yeah, how can people follow you and continue to learn from your wisdom that you've created together?
You go first. Yeah, you're the...
Right now, my main Instagram page is focused on being an advocate in the special needs community. You know, I've been a health and fitness coach for 14 years, and moms, especially moms like myself, they don't need another diet. They need to understand their nervous system. They need to understand the reason behind their behaviors. They need to understand how their body is responding to their emotions. They need to stop numbing their emotions. And so a lot of what I've been doing on the health and wellness side has shifted to really helping women support and understand what their nervous system is. So if you go to My Coach Lacey, it's L-A-C-Y, I'm sharing about, you know, what we're experiencing with our daughters. I'm sharing about the nervous system. I'm teaching about the nervous system, speaking about the hard parts of special need parenting that a lot of people don't talk about it from the perspective of this isn't something that has to end your life. There is hope. There are ways to manage it. There's ways to feel better. There's ways to feel empowered, even if you're in a situation like we are that can be really, really difficult sometimes.
That's good. I know. I love following you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you all for coming on and doing it, bro.
We do have cute kids, don't we? Yeah. Yeah, and you can find me at the Team Never Quit Speakers Bureau. That's probably the best place to find me. And if I can come in and talk to your group, I'd love to. So find me there.
Yeah. Yeah, he is on our Speakers Bureau, and Teresa can handle that. So thank you all for coming in and sharing your stories with us.
Thank you. It was wonderful to have you guys. It was good to be back at the ranch.
Great job, brother. Good job, Liz.
Thanks.